Welcome to Better Cybersecurity, the ISF podcast. I'm your host, Steve Durbin.
ISF Chief Executive Steve Durbin is an expert in leadership, business culture transformation, and cyber strategies for today's top enterprises. I'm producer Tavia Gilbert. Today, we welcome back one of our favorite guests, Peter Hinson. A renowned keynote speaker, author, and serial entrepreneur, Peter is one of the most sought-after thought leaders on radical innovation, leadership, and the impact of all things digital on society and business. When Peter was last on the show, the world had just begun to recover from the COVID-19 pandemic, and generative AI was still in its infancy. This time around, Steve and Peter talk about the advancements of AI and what they mean for the C-suite, whether the tech companies have become too powerful, AI regulation, and the future of leadership. Peter also answers how we will remember this AI boom in 10 years.
I'm joined today on the podcast by one of the most sought-after thought leaders on radical innovation, leadership, and the impact of all things digital on society and business, Peter Hinson. Peter, welcome back. How have you been?
Very nice to be here, Steve. Really well, and good to see you again.
Nice to have you. Now, you were one of our keynote speakers at our annual Congress back in 2023. Try to think back all that while generative AI had just burst onto the scene, and now it's pretty much everywhere. What's your take on that? Are we nearing maturity with it? Where are we, do you think?
It's a fascinating moment. I've been in the world of technology now for 33 years. And honestly, the last 3 years have been the most exciting roller coaster ride I have ever seen. I think the world we've gotten into as a result of AI has never been more exciting. It's also never been more scary. And I think it's a fascinating thing where we've also never had so much technology become mainstream drama. And I think that's one of the fascinating things. I'm sure you're familiar with the Real Housewives franchise. I think sometimes...
Watch it all the time, Peter. All the time, as you can imagine.
Sometimes I think we've arrived in the Real Housewives of artificial intelligence. Now, they've become mainstream attention grabbers. But it's also a world where I have never seen so much money being involved. Just a stupid data point, but I've taken the CapEx spending that the big tech four giants, so Meta, Google, Amazon, and Microsoft, are going to do this year alone. And that is $610 billion building infrastructure for AI, basically the data centers, CapEx spending. And I've just calculated, when you look at the really big investments on our planet over the last 75 years, the Manhattan Project, if you would calculate that in today's budget, is about $35 billion. The Apollo Project, which ran for 8 years, is $300 billion. What these four companies alone are spending just in infrastructure is twice the Apollo Project, which is something we've never seen. So I think it's a combination of excitement and awe. But one thing is for sure, this is a roller coaster ride.
No, it is. And it's not without its challenges, is it? Now, you spent years helping leaders focus on the day after tomorrow. In this sort of era that we're talking about, you've just highlighted the amount of investment that's going in. That horizon seems to move ever increasingly closer. How should leaders react? How should they redefine this long-term strategy? I mean, the ISF, we're going through that strategy process ourselves at the moment. And long-term, certainly for me, is pretty much the next 6 months. Because the technology cycles are now so much faster than any form of boardroom cycle. What sort of words of advice and guidance can you offer?
Really good question. So I think I agree. We're now in a world where the cycles move faster than ever before. The stakes are higher. And I think a lot of the instruments that we had from the past just don't work anymore. I take the annual budget as the finest example. Annual budgets are yearly sarcastic corporate rituals now, where people put fake news in Excel that consolidates into things that never work anymore. I think that's the realization of that never normal. And on the one hand, you still have people who hold on to this idea that this is just a phase. This is just, it's just a lot of turbulence right now. But very soon, we're going to be able to take our seatbelts off. And I think it's fundamentally wrong. I think instead of seeing this as a storm, I think we have to see this as a new climate. And I think this is the climate that we're going to have to get used to. I think this constant change, this relentless complexity of change that is happening, this volatility, I think is going to be the new never normal. And I think that's what we have to get used to. And you're right in asking, how do companies deal with that? And I think for me, three things are important. One, the ability to pick up the signals, the ability to understand and sense what is out there is more important than ever before. So this idea of picking up the signals is crucial. Number two is being agile and being flexible to interpret that and to be able to basically translate those signals into actions. And three, you're not always going to get everything right. And there's an absolute fear of failure in many companies. But this is the age where you're only going to find out by trying and experimenting. And that's why the third element is resilience. The capability to bounce back is going to become more important than ever before. But that holy trinity for me, Steve, is what matters. It's this idea of anticipating, picking up the signals. It's this fundamental mechanism of agility to be able to react fast enough. And three, there's the resilience. And I think that is the holy combination to make that work.
And getting people comfortable with that, Peter, that's going to be the challenge, isn't it? And I'm just thinking, I had a conversation yesterday with a board member who was complaining to me about the cost of AI. And we were talking about private versus public and the different aspects of that. And he was saying, you know, I just don't know where all this expense and cost is going to end. And the challenge I face, he said, is how can I, with a degree of certainty, which I think was the real problem, because there is none, but how can I, with a degree of certainty, place the right bet? I'm paraphrasing, of course, but that's the challenge, I think, in the boardroom now, isn't it?
It is, absolutely. And I think it's an interesting choice of words, because placing the right bet, I think, is maybe what we have to get used to. But the idea that we can do strategy the way that we did in the old normal, just it doesn't apply anymore. I think this is where we have to completely rethink our framework of thinking about these things. And it's not easy. Look at what you described, just the cost of AI. The number one conversation that I have with CIOs or CTOs of companies, I said, okay, when you look at your IT budget in the next 5 years, or maybe even 10 years, do you think that your IT budget is going to go up or down? And honestly, they have no idea. The only thing they can probably say is, with everything that is happening, we're probably going to spend more on compute, because that is a big factor. Mm-hmm. We might spend less on software. But look at how software development has completely changed in 18 months. I spent a lot of time in the Bay Area and Silicon Valley since November last year when Anthropic released Opus 4.5. We have seen a spectacular rise in autonomous software development. Mm-hmm. And as a result of that, the entire IT landscape has become liquid. We had the famous SaaS apocalypse, where traditional SaaS companies all of a sudden saw their market value plummet because building software is in a completely different state than it was just basically a year ago. So I think that means that we have more liquidity, volatility, uncertainty than ever. And I think companies are going to have to deal with that. And one of the things that I find really interesting is that holding on to the old strategic frameworks just doesn't work anymore. And one of the things that I'm seeing is a revival of scenario thinking. And that is fascinating, because I wrote a book called The Uncertainty Principle on how to make sense of this crazy world. And one of the things I did there is I went back into the origins of scenario thinking. And one of the stories that I always find fascinating is Shell, who was, I think, the only oil company during the big oil crisis of the 1970s that actually thrived. And the reason is they had a scenario thinking cell inside the company who had been looking at what could have happened, what could possible scenarios be. And when the oil crisis hit, the other oil companies were baffled, but Shell actually had trained their muscle memory in a way with these scenario thinking. And I think what we might need to do in this crazy, turbulent, uncertain times is maybe a revival of that scenario thinking in companies, in their strategic framework and into boardrooms. I think we might see a complete revival of a very ancient art.
It is an ancient art, and I'm still a fan of it. We still use that, as you probably remember, in our Threat Horizon reports, where we plumped for scenarios a few years ago now, and it seems to be a very popular way still. So maybe this is an opportunity for the security side of the business to teach the business side of the business a thing or two. That would be nice, wouldn't it?
It would, absolutely. But it is a strange world. Look at what happened in the world of AI and security, right? At this moment, the number one conversation I have with executives is around the Anthropic Mythos debate, right? Anthropic develops a new model that is so powerful, capable of cybersecurity in ways that we never thought was possible. And instead of releasing that, they said, no, this is way too dangerous. We're not going to release it, which is probably a good reflex. And then they had a meeting where they decided that these 40 companies are going to be the companies that we give it just to test out and brace and prepare yourself. But imagine being in that room where you have to decide who's your buddy and who's not, who's in the 40 and who's out. And this is an age where it's not governments anymore who make these decisions. It is individual tech companies. And I think that adds to that enormous amount of complexity and anxiety that is out there.
Have they become too powerful, do you think, Peter, the tech companies?
I think we're in a situation where they are basically advancing so quickly that you can not have any type of regulatory framework that is still applicable. And I think that's what we're seeing. We're seeing a breakdown where all the mechanisms that we had put in place to guide and regulate work well for industries that move at a relatively slow pace. But in a world that moves so quickly, I take the example of Europe. Europe, which has always had a regulatory reflex,
right.
We're now beginning to see that what we did in Europe with AI regulation was actually really stupid in the sense that we started regulatory ideas and concepts even before the technology was mature. By the time it came out, we had to correct it because then all of a sudden generative AI came out. But we're now in a situation where you can clearly see that the way that we started to think about this regulation was still way too reactive. And I think what we need to do also in the regulatory environment is put a lot more of that forward-looking scenario thinking complexity into that. And I think this mismatch in the world of tech is now to an extreme proportion. And I think these companies are not evil. There might be some, but I think the majority of these companies want to try and build something that has a long-term sustainable impact. But you can clearly now see that there is a mismatch between reality and what we're trying to do to control them.
Yeah, there is. And how do you see that panning out? Regulators traditionally have always been lagging. That's the nature of it, right? It was interesting what you said about the EU AI Act, which I agree with you. I mean, it was first out of the blocks, really, wasn't it? It was trying to set things. I don't think anyone anticipated the speed at which AI would morph and change around that. But we've talked for quite some while in the industry about the role that the regulator plays. People have fallen back on compliance. Security, we're very big on policies and standards and that kind of thing. What you've just been describing, though, is an environment in which all of that could disappear. So where do we go?
Yeah, just to echo that, I was doing a presentation for the board of a big bank, a European bank, last week. And we had a really good conversation on what AI was doing and how it was impacting them. And then we came to the subject of security. So the Mythos thing came up.
Yeah.
And of course, you have in Europe, the DORA legislation, which is significant, and compliance for banks is a pretty tough cookie to get through.
Yeah.
And I asked the CTO, I said, the discussions you now have with your national bank and with the European Central Bank on cybersecurity, and he said, it's tough. Right? And then I said, but when you look at Mythos, are you getting any guidance from the European Central Bank on that? And he said, there is none. And that is really scary, where we got into that environment, where we have more and more rules and more compliance, but it's almost seems like it's penny wise and pound foolish in a world which is changing so quickly. Honestly, when you think about it, I do think that this is not a storm, but the new climate. I think we're going to have to completely rethink that. So I go back to this anticipate, pick up the signals, being super agile, being resilient. That, I think, is the very heart of dealing with that enormous amount of change out there.
I agree with you. And yet, if I look at the corporate landscape, doesn't matter, pick a country, doesn't matter. The majority, we talk about, you know, let's grasp the opportunity, let's be agile, let's not be quite so risk averse. But the majority of companies are still so wedded into whether it be quarterly earnings, shareholder value, all of these sorts of things, that the boardroom is really struggling to balance all of these things up. Because if they make one wrong move, they're going to be punished in the markets. And so how do you think we can navigate through? Because I agree with you, we need to be more agile and risk-taking, but it's a huge challenge, isn't it?
It is. And that's why I think this age of AI is different. And I think a lot of people, when we started having more and more of the AI movement just 2 or 3 years ago, saw this as the next wave of the digital transformation. Mm. And I think that is not the case. And I think there is a profound change. Going back to the bank last week, they said, well, when you look at the digital transformation that we went through as a bank, it completely changed the entire relationship with our customers. Because right. instead of our customers coming in a bank branch, we now do everything or pretty much everything on the mobile phone. And the entire relationship with our customers completely changed because of digital. But they said, when you look inside the bank, the way that we are organized, the way that we process, the way that we work is still very much the same. And they said, we have the same departments, we have the same process flows, but now AI is not just going to change the customer side, it is profoundly going to change the way we work. And they made the analogy, and I loved it. They said, we compare it, the digital transformation was cosmetic surgery. AI is open heart surgery. And that's why I think this is more profound. And to your point, a lot of companies are not prepared to do that, where it goes to the question, what kind of leaders do we need for these types of fundamental transformations? And I've done a lot of work in the retail sector over the last couple of years. I wrote a book on the transformation of Walmart called The Phoenix and the Unicorn. For me, Walmart is a phoenix because a company of 1.7 million employees transforming itself and becoming relevant in the digital e-commerce hybrid environment was fabulous. Walmart became a $1 trillion market cap company, and they are one of the success stories of digital transformation. The guy who did that was Doug McMillon, and he's one of my favorite CEOs in the world. I have tremendous respect for him. He was the one who took Walmart from an old school traditional retailer to a really good player into the age of online and e-commerce. He did the digital transformation. Took him about 7 years. Mm-hmm. And then he resigned, Steve, in February of this year.
Right.
And he said, you know what? AI is literally going to change every job. I want to get as many people to the other side as possible, but I am not the leader to do that. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was incredibly powerful that he came to that conclusion where he said, I was the guy who did the digital transformation, but I am not the leader because AI is not just a continuation. This is a fundamental rethinking of everything that we do. And for me, that is an illustration of that never normal, because maybe we need different types of leaders for that never normal. Right. Maybe we need people who are capable of surfing that complexity and navigating that uncertainty and are capable of taking their people into this new climate. And I think their capabilities of making sense, their capabilities of helping organizations to move into that, maybe completely rethinking organizations for this new age, I think this might be an opportunity for new leaders to step up.
Where do you think they're going to come from, Peter?
It's a really good question. I teach at London Business School, and I made a really stupid remark the last time that I was teaching at the MBA program. I said, well, I'm very happy to be here and welcome to the MBA program. I'm really glad that you've chosen the best education for the last century. That didn't go down very well. But honestly, when you look at a lot of the traditional ways that we've been training leaders, it was on helping them make sense of a world that was relatively stable. And talks about the boom post World War II. You had the boom period, then you had the age of contention, oil crisis, and all the complexity of Russia falling apart. And then the fact that we've now had an era of global markets for 25 years, which has basically been the majority of how we think about running companies today. I think since COVID, we can clearly see that it's not just a temporary phase. This is a fundamental new era. I think we're entering an era of flux. We might be in for a period of 10, 15, 20 years of continuous change and volatility. And I think this might require a different leadership style, capability. And I was trained at London Business School by Rob Goffey, who was one of my heroes. He brought me in a long time ago. And when he brought me into London Business School, he just written that book, Why Should Anyone Be Led by You? And I recently reread that book, and it's still incredibly actual in this day and age. And I've seen him do this many times. He would walk into a boardroom filled with board members of amazing accolades and resumes and amazing stuff. And he would wait for the room to quiet down and look them in the eye and say, why should anyone be led by you? And I think that's the type of question that we need to ask ourselves today in this never normal. So where are they going to come from? I don't know. We might have to nurture them. We might have to grow them. We might have to develop them. I don't think there's a school or a business school you can go to be completely prepared for the age of never normal and disruption. And I think we might need to nurture, build, develop. But I fundamentally believe that these leaders, they're going to have to build a sense of urgency without scaring people. They're going to have to lead companies into probably the most disruptive age of technology, but not polarize between the old and the new, because then it won't work. I think they need the shared mindset, and they need to empower the innovators. And I think that's probably a different type of leader that we needed for the classical old normal.
Yeah, I'm sitting here listening to that, and that seems to me as well to favor the smaller companies rather than the very large ones. Would that be fair?
I think it is. And I think I often look at the large beasts, because these Walmarts of 1.7 million capable of transforming are amazing. And it's wonderful to see that.
Yeah.
But the truth is, the larger the company is, the more difficult it is to get that change going. And that's why inherently smaller organizations have, I think, a competitive advantage, because being agile, being nimble, and being resilient should be easier for a smaller company than a larger organization. When I look at these phoenixes, companies who can transform themselves, one of my favorite examples is Microsoft, right? 51 years old. Microsoft is now one of the top 10 market cap companies in the world, a company that is on top of everything that is AI and the cloud. And when you look at it, this is a company that has grown for 51 years. And for the first 30 years, it was just wow. And then it just, And at a certain moment, Microsoft had become, a really big bureaucratic machine. And it became a machine for collecting money. Innovation just wasn't natural to them anymore. And when Satya Nadella came on board, I remember he said, I think there's 8 Googles inside of our R&D department, but because of bureaucracy, they're not getting out anymore. And he made the right strategic choice. The move to the cloud was absolutely fantastic. But then he was able to then change the entire culture and mindset of the organization. And he was a big fan of Carol Dweck. He read Carol Dweck's book, The Growth Mindset. And that's what he did at Microsoft. And instead of seeing everything as a challenge and a problem, see it as an opportunity to learn and grow. And if you now see Microsoft at 51 years old, it's the perfect example of a phoenix. And that's why I think Satya Nadella is a great example of that type of leader. He didn't try to just continue the old. He accepted a new reality, and he tried to completely put that mindset for reinvention at the very heart of what they do. So I think that's the type of leadership that we're going to need.
Now, I'm conscious that perhaps some people listening to this are feeling perhaps a little bit overwhelmed by the sort of sheer velocity of the change that we're talking about. What was the one conversation you think that they should have with their leadership team, say tomorrow, that they aren't having today that can ground this a little bit for them?
I think the question I would put to people is that because of AI, the one thing that's going to change is we're going to be able to scale intelligence in our companies without scaling headcount. And that is a fundamental conversation to have. So one of the things that happened this year, Steve, is that end of February, I think it was the 28th of February, the American FinTech Block announced their quarterly earnings. And Block is very popular in the US, outside of the US, not so much. But I always describe Block as it's like the US Revolut. That's the easiest way to put it. And the founder of the company and the CEO of the company, he announced that they were firing 4,000 people of 10,000 in total, and because of AI. And the quarterly report is a super interesting read, because he said, we believe our company will be more valuable as a smaller, faster, intelligence-native company. And he said, I don't think that we are early. I think most companies are late. Since that moment, it's the number one conversation I have with executives who also want to be faster and smaller. And I know what that means. I'm not entirely sure what intelligence-native means. But this is going to be a question that we have as leaders. how is our organization going to evolve if we can scale intelligence without scaling headcount? And I think it's the first time that we have the technological means to make that happen. And I don't believe that being AI first, what many companies want, means people last. I don't. But I think that is a conversation you need to have. I could even conceive of a future where being AI first could even be a human premium, but it's not going to happen by itself. And I think this is where, as a leader, you need to take that up, have those frank and candid discussions, because we are entering a world where how we think about humans and how we think about intelligence, I think, is never going to be the same again.
Fascinating. When we look back at this sort of AI revolutionary period that we're going through, let's say in a decade's time, Peter, how do you think we'll remember it?
I think we probably haven't seen the real impact yet. I go back to that work thing. I was in Silicon Valley a few weeks ago. We were doing a tour with some European executives to Silicon Valley, and we were meeting a startup founder. And I'm having coffee with the guy before I introduce him to the group. And I ask him a stupid question. I ask him, how many employees do you have?
Right.
The moment the words left my mouth, I could see I made a mistake, because I could see his eyes rolling back. I could see him thinking, oh my God, what a boomer question. And his answer was 300, of which 30 are meat-based. Now, this was a provocation, right? But this is a guy who had built a company with 270 agents doing things like customer service and procurement and legal, and only 30 of them were human.
Right.
And I think for the longest time, you would measure the impact of a company by the headcount. That is no longer the case. And I think if we look back at this, many people compare it to the Industrial Revolution. And I think it was Demis Hassabis from Google DeepMind who said this could be 10 times bigger than the Industrial Revolution. For me, it's two things coming together. When you look at the printing press moment, we had the industrialization of knowledge, where we went from monks transcribing books into an abundance of information. And then we had the Industrial Revolution, where we went from muscle to machine. I think this is where the two of them are coming together. That's why this is so intense. And I think we're going to have to understand how we go from building companies with humans to building companies with humans plus intelligence. And I think for me, that is probably going to be something that when we look back, I think we will see this as one of the great big pivots in how we think about societies and economies.
Fantastic. We'll have to get together again in 10 years' time, Peter, and see whether or not you were right.
Thank you very much.
It's been fascinating talking to you. Thank you so much. Always a pleasure. I'm sure our listeners have got a huge amount from this particular podcast. Peter Hinson, thank you very much.
It was a pleasure to be here, Steve. See you soon.
See you soon.
Thank you for listening. We'll be back next week with more expert insights and thought-provoking discussions. But in the meantime, if you really enjoyed today's episode, please take a moment to rate, review, and share the podcast. If you're interested in becoming an ISDEF member or continuing the conversation further, please do get in touch with me at steve.durbin@securityforum.org, or indeed get hold of me on LinkedIn. And remember, you can explore all our media and resources at our website, securityforum.org.